Oh.
And your probably your date of birth. When you first came to Ely, the year you first came to Ely.
I was born in Ely. I was born in my grandfather's house in Silver Street. And I went to school in Ely. Partly. I lived overseas as a boy for 3 years. And I went back to the Middle East when I was in the military, you know, so that I went backwards and forwards, but I always came back to Ely. I was baptised in St Mary's. I was what he called in the cathedral by the Bishop of Ely, so that I've always been connected with Ely. I've come back to it, even if I've lived in several parts of the country and the world. I've always, Ely's my home. Born the 22nd of November 1925 in Ely. I was demobbed. At least I came home in May 1947. The floods had been, and you know, they was rushing around repairing what they could, and I saw the advert in the paper, you know, about the staff for the catchment board, and so I applied. And I had an interview with a New Zealander, Mr. Mowbray. He was a deputy chief. And because I fitted the bill, I was appointed July 47. And my first job was to assist with the repair, you know, the survey and whatnot, of the repair of the breaches. Well, when the breach had been sealed, which, you know, took some time, and some of them took a couple of years, because there's lots of foundation work to be done, I then went on to... I was given the pits to look after, because they used to measure their capacity or what they... in barge loads. And they had the old-fashioned barges. They were steel ones, or wooden ones, when I went there originally. But when we got... I better explain. Because of the essential works that the River Authority, or River, had to do, the Ministry of Supply released a lot of prefabricated steel barges together with one prefabricated steel tug, and that's Vermuiden. And we built it down the depot, and I used it frequently for hydrographic surveys of the 100 foot. And also down into the wash when we was researching all the data for the flood protection scheme, so that we got quite a large volume of information which went towards the review of the flood protection scheme, which had come up during the war, but had to be revised on the basis of the 47 flood. Yeah. The discharges were much higher than velocities were, so that they had to review it. And I went down to Lynn for a time with Randy Johnson, who was my mentor. And we had a caravan down. For a time, the Fenoffs became too crowded, so we moved temporarily to Wychford Airfield, Common Road, in the Nissenhut style, while they built the first permanent headquarters at Prickler Road. And so the whole of the Pitts area was really in a state of confusion. So I was given the job of bringing it into a proper system whereby we could dig clay in enormous quantities and load the barges, and they'd be towed to all the jobs by... they had some tugs of their own, the Catron Board did, or the Old South Level, of Reedhawk, Sheldrake, and a Leader 1 and 2, I think. But we were later reinforced when the sugar beet factory at Ely stopped river traffic. And so we acquired quite a fleet of their barges, which weren't as big as our big Dowmax, but they were very handy thing. And some tugs. We had two or three tugs off them, so that we was able to reinforce the clay and also supply large quantities of clay to the, you know, all the bank work. I ought to tell you at this stage that we had a prisoner of ex-prisoner of war camp at West Fen Road in Ely, and we also had the use of 200 displaced persons that came to work on the board, so that we had an enlarged labour force which we were able to do more jobs at a time, which meant that we had to have a more practical practice of extracting clay. And because we wanted to have a loading face, we had a berm. We always kept a berm at the bottom, which has allowed the drag lines to sit there, and we had the bulldozers pushing the stuff down the slope to them.
All right.
So that we always had clay, hard, solid clay, for the works. You see, it's all right if you use a wet pit and dredge like they had done in the old pits, but dry clay, one, you're not carrying water, and two, it compacts much better. So that we'd start to get organised, and my job was to organise it and measure it, because they'd want quantities, especially in other parts of the district where we didn't own the land, but we would pay a royalty. I think it was about sixpence a cubic yard, something like that, which was a lot of money then. But that was an all. Do you have access to all our drawings from those days?
We do. They're at Brampton, Harry.
Oh.
Yes, yeah.
Because you'll find a lot of the surveys there, which I did, the pit surveys, at Southery, Redmere, another one down Sam Fen, Chris Pitt. We used to, and he had, and some of them were chalky, clunch pits, which were used for foundations for the tracks. That used to be good. So that we started to get organised as a, it was way back in the, it hadn't changed over the years, and it had to grow up quickly. And so I was put in to sort the pits out, get it organised, and also it had to be stable. We couldn't have any slips, so the slopes were always fixed. I forget what it was now, about 1 in 4 or something like that. And the bulldozer used to, you know, keep chasing it down the slope onto the berm, and we'd gradually eat the berm back, and you know, the pits were get almost up to the boundary hedge. You know where Bill Summers' caravan was? At the top. Yeah. Well, we made the edge a fixed distance, you know, the top of the slope, and that we wouldn't go any further back towards the hedge, so that we had a definite line which we couldn't advance the slope anymore, and so we then had to look for fresh supplies, so that we had dry pits. We had the one near the sailing hut, you know, the yacht. That was a dry pit to start with, and then when we wanted to use, of course, we built that, we'd taken it out by lorry. What we want to do is use the rest of it to the maximum by loading into barges. So we cut an opening and put a small box girder bridge over it for the traffic. We had to maintain the right of way to the railway crossing into Daveland. So we did that, and that went all right. And we reinforced the edge of the sailing clubs. We used asbestos sheeting, a lot of that. I did several miles of that, and the 10 mile and whatnot later on.
The dry pit.
To the left of the, you know, you go across that short bit of the common to get to the sailing club. If you go straight on, it takes you to Daveland over the loop. And most of the soil was dug out in that area towards the corner. When I arrived at the catchment board in 47, Jack Lupson had been started work in Queen Victoria's reign. He retired. In fact, I've got some photos somewhere of those. They had dinner, proper official retirement.
Oh, right.
Because he'd, well, he, well, I think he was about 75 or something like that. He was, and he also had a younger brother, Bob, that used to work around the pits. He used to cut the hedges and, you know, make wooden pegs that were used for levels. And he also had three sons. They all worked for the board. He was general foreman when I arrived. He could tell you about the flood of 1936. I mean, he was a marvellous old man, Jack, the original general foreman he was then. And he had, I think, his young Jack. He had a brother, Bob. There were several Lupsons work on the Ozod. Originally, they used to have wheelbarrows and running deals. You know, on thick planks, 4 inches, about 12 inches wide.
Yeah.
And they would run it down. What happened, I could demonstrate it better on the, that area between the original road down to the crossing. You remember, don't you, dear?
Yeah.
Before.
When I used to live down in Adelaide, I used to come up along the cinder path because it was a shortcut to where I lived, and come up past the River Authority. Yeah. And in front of our house, the railway used to, the little train used to run. Yes, and I used to take the, it was a shortcut, you see, used to go up and along the line and then over the railway crossing and up past Ray's office and to work.
Oh, right.
Yes.
Right. Yeah. And is your house still there, or has it been knocked down? Is your house still there? Or
no.
It was knocked down?
It was in the 1932 Ideal Home exhibition. It was all made of wood.
It was prefabricated.
Yes.
Oh, right.
Yes, and it was lovely. It really was. All wood. And had a fireplace in each room. And like that. Yes, and it was called Wheel Cottage because it had the wheel on the gate.
Oh, right.
And lovely big garden, wasn't it, Ray?
Yes.
Yes.
A long garden.
Yes, and the bottom of it used to go across to the pits, didn't we?
Yeah.
Where Dad used to go shooting.
Oh,
there
right.
Was a, like a big deep ditch, and there's a plank. And he used to go with all, you know, the men from the factory shooting.
Yeah. And that was at the time that the...
Yeah.
Before the first pit was dug, or was
yes,
it?
That was before, wasn't it, right? Then, when was... Because we, as a child, as a young girl, well, about 10, I used to walk across what was the pits.
Yeah.
You know, come from the railway, get across there.
Yeah, yeah.
Of course, it's all changed, hasn't it, you
of
see?
Of course it has, hasn't
yeah.
it? Yeah.
Yes, but yes, it's because it's quite a steep hill going
if you
from
look
the Crickwell Road
the
down. I suppose just whisk down
yeah.
there.
You'll
and
see between
no,
the Sailing
the
Club
were
where they
ever
sail
so friendly,
at the moment.
You know?
Hang on, let me just.
Right, yeah.
Oh, yes, if you look at the old ordnance sheet, say the 1927 edition, you'll notice. It didn't extend beyond what looked like a group of islands of land. And they were a series of hand-dug pits from the old times before what Roswell Main was thought of. It was when the old road ran alongside, like from the corner, down to the railway. You know, there's a bridge over the railway line that comes into the old pits, and the barges used to come through there.
Yes.
Well, joining that area to the common, they had a series of hand-dug pits. They used to dig it and bar it up into the barges, and then they used to have a cut through, so they all became interconnected like so many different basins. They weren't all that big or deep, and they went right up to the corner of the common. And one of the jobs I did when we wanted to really, you know, get going on the finish off the, I'll call it the Sailing Club pit. When we wanted to make it easier for the tugs and barges to come through there, we cleared some of the islands out where you use a dredger and took them out, so it became quite small and plenty of channel for the tugs to manoeuvre. I mean, when you've got a line of, say, 10 barges, You got to adjust the chains each time it makes a turn. It's, we used to make it easier. Yeah. They could come out of the main pit and ready to go through the tunnel into the river. We wanted to make it possible for the barges, the tugs and barges, to get out of the conflicted area.
Yeah.
And we wanted to trim up the sailing club area, because we had quite a bit of land alongside the railway line, the loop. And we went back to that line, to the loop. Well, we kept some distance away with the stable slope, but that was the idea. We wanted to clean up everywhere. You know, you get bits and pieces and nobody knows what's happening or where to go, so that we got organised. What we wanted to do was clear up, get rid of all the bits and pieces, and have a properly organised supply for tippers and barges. And that's what we succeeded in doing. We used up all the gash land alongside the railway and the loop and in the what's bit was a dry pit originally. So what we did is we cleaned it all up. We got the maximum out, and then we started to dig big lumps out of the Ely West, which is that big pit. You know, you go over the bridge to the depot. Well, we built the bridge. Thomas Freeman was the contractor. Van Oostrom was the designer, and I was the engineer for it. By then, we'd cleared a lot of the old stuff up, and we wanted capacity. And to start with, that was a tipper. We could load tippers there in the dry, and they had a good road, you know, up the hill to escape it. So that became a source of mass extraction. But there came a time when we wanted to get at it with the tugs and barges, because our tipper fleet was getting smaller. A lot of it was not redundant, surplus service, MOD, tippers. And also we had some from McAlpines that were part of their fleet that had done the repair of the washers banks, you know, the middle level and south level barrier banks. Well, they were the contractors, and they used lots of tippers there, and they used a pit at Sutton, a pit there.
Around about the, this is the early 50s now, there was some plesiosaur, big fish.
Plesiosaur.
Yeah, sorry, yeah. To
it's
ask
a
you,
stratum.
Stratum.
I can tell you the name of the, who came down from the British Museum to examine it and name it a plesiosaur. We had a complete skeleton, and they, you know, identified it and took what they wanted. Quite a number of local people took samples, which they returned later when they was trying to restore it and take it away to rebuild it, if you like. Yes. And it, I'm just trying to think of his name, quite a young man from the museum came down, Jack Wolfe was, I think, the dragline driver loading the lorries, and he spotted something, you know how you... And so he stopped, and they called the experts in, because although we find bones in the pit, so when we got circular domes, ammonites, he thought that, he stomped, and he did, and reported it, and they came down and identified what it was. And it was the first time we'd got a complete skeleton. We've always been able to find bits and pieces, especially bits of legs and things like that. But to find a real one that you could, actually... It was quite a story at the time. I think the Ely Standard, the local papers, I saw the whole thing. Yeah. I'd been collecting bits and pieces at the office for ages, from Roswell Pits, I think. What's name? Elwood. Snowy Elwood was loading there, and they found. No, this was a prehistoric. I think it was a human bone that we had at the office that they'd found in the clay, from the last ice ages, because we had a lot of stuff transported by the ice age, the clunch in layers. So I remember saving that at the office for a while. What we tried to do was always hand them on into the record section. Like when we evacuated the Fen office, they sold it. We sent everything to Cambridge, to the records office, what our head office didn't want. But we put it into the county archives. We tried to make sure all our discoveries and all our knowledge went back either to head office, to the county archives, or the museum. Now there was something in. That was Uncle
Michael Warwick. What?
His photos.
Oh,
went
he took
to,
all the photos of the floods, didn't he?
Yes.
That's right. That's
were
right.
Held in the Fitzwilliam, didn't he? Hand them over to the.
He handed them over because he had an exhibition, didn't he?
Yes.
He went to it in Cambridge. I can't really remember, but he. When, since ever, heard those floods, he was a keen photographer, and of course he made quite a bit of money, took them up to the...
He'd sell them to,
the newspapers.
What was his name?
Lane.
Lane.
Walter Martin Lane.
His faith uncle.
Yeah. But he was a very keen photographer, wasn't he?
He was very good.
He was good.
He had a snout for,
A good photo.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean...
And he took a whole series of them, so that they were very valuable in terms of the history of the flood. Because he covered a lot of ground.
Can you perhaps just relay any memories you've got of the Roswell once it kind of got to the end of its kind of working life?
Well, I retired, as I said, in 1988. I'd served 41 years then. And the pits had been worked out in a sense that I think they filled in or put some the gates against the, you know, the bridge that we built. I think it was built in 1952, which allowed us to take barges through into that pit, but most of it was dug using tippers. It was a dry pit, but then Van Neusden decided that it was economical to break through the rock layer, which was not very deep down, and get to the good clay underneath. And that's where, you know, these slopes came in, because as under the flood protection scheme, or I believe it was that, we acquired Common Farm. Well, we'd acquired it to safeguard clay for the barges. But initially, we used it as a dry loader into tippers. We acquired a fleet of tippers. But it came to a stage where we'd work down to the hard claystone, you know, these great big boulders. And so Van Neusden decided we would break through and put a bridge in. Actually, we built the bridge in the dry. What we did, we bulldozed where the opening was, the bridge was going to be, down to a level where it would support the actual bridge construction. And that's what we did. And so, now I'm trying to think of the name of the people. The people that had the contract, Freemans, the ones that built the Sydney Harbour Bridge. The bridge was put there so that we could get the floating gear into the dry pit. So we then had another source, and it was economical to have one big drag line there, which can load barges at a heck of a rate, and they could travel all over the South Level system. I mean, we had some really super dragline drivers there. We had, what's his name, Elwood? Oh, what was his name? Snubby. And there was another one, his father, Harry Neal's son, Eddie Neal, was another lovely driver. You know, they used to finger the barges with their buckets, pull them in and take them out of position. They were marvellous, had a touch.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And actually, Eddie taught me to drive, but I was never allowed to do anything. That's how the saw mechanics, I'm trying to think of it. He went to Canada ultimately, the one that was at Coldham Lane. Yeah. but they worked out all the soap for us for any given, because we had saw mechanics, they used to come down and do all the samples. So we had unconfined compression tests and all the rest of it. And from it, they used to work out safe slopes for any given material, which we used to apply to our designs. So that we wouldn't allow anyone to cut any trees down on the big slope on the common, you know, where it's all wooded and whatnot. No one touched that. Unsailing.
And why was that, Harry?
We couldn't afford any slips. It was a steep slope, and the roots and whatnot held it all together. And so it was wise not to let anything happen that would take the restraining factor of all the trees and shrubs and things held it. And of course, we also had to have some thought for nature, so that we didn't want to... it was a favourite place for the fishermen. They used to, you know, walk down the slope and fish at the bottom. And also, the fish used to swarm, you know, in the season and lay their eggs in the roots where they were into the water, so that we could see them. See the eggs. That's where the water's led, at the water's edge. All the roots used to grow out as and into the water, and the roots used to, not all of the roots, but some of the smaller roots, side shoots, used to grow out into the pits because it was water for the trees in drought. Yeah. And also, the fish used to lay their eggs and, you know, spawn in the finer, fibrous roots of the... So that... and of course it was a great fishing, and nature lovers, and sailing, and walks, and lovers. It was called Lover's Lane. It was all Lover's Lane went from waterside, you know, that area, all the way along to where the depot is, and then it used to be down to, was it Turbotsea Farm? There used to be a farm at the where the sugar beet factory was built, and yes, it's Turbotsea Farm. That was a settling pond, the original settling pond for the factory, but it got, you know, totally overwhelmed by the quantity of and so they had big settling ponds across the river, and the barges in the old days used to be drawn by horses, and where they used to walk alongside the rivers were called hailingways. And so the horses had a firm, they were like little footpaths. They used to harden them up in places, so they were safe. And where you came to a boundary, they had low fences where the horses, they used to call them horse jumps. They used to jump over them, They were trained. You see, they would walk on and off the boats. Although it was feudalistic system, if you like, it worked.
Can you remember any stories or incidents that happened around the pits? And one we've got was the sinking of barges.
Oh, well, one of the... You know, when we were talking about the link pit between the railway bridge and the outer, there was one of the old-fashioned wooden barges. Now I'm going to tell you a fib. It was in the old pits, Roswell, Maine. You know, there was a series of islands.
Yes.
There was one of the old wooden barges, you know, that were horse-drawn, had been left to rot there, been tied up and left. And now I've got an idea. A section of the university lock came and rescued it and took it away to inquire into its construction. Of course, they were very heavy timber barges and well made. I just had a look at it when I was cruising around there, one of the launches. But as I say, all the reeds and rushes were growing up around it because it had been sunk on the...
Yeah, so it's actually sunk.
Sunk on the one of the island in that spread between the point of the pits and the railway bridge.
Yeah.
There. And they came and rescued it and took it away. And as far as I know, it went to Cambridge University because I think they wanted to explore its manufacture, how its design and structure. But anything they made wooden like that in the old days was very securely.
Yeah.
We were lucky. Rufus Scarborough, who was the chief carpenter, and his son Ted was also a very, I would say, well qualified carpenter too, made all the wooden structures, like all the boats, wooden boats and punts and things they dealt with. All the big wooden gates, like for Denver and whatnot, they used to have the big timbers. I think they were 14 by 14 by about 30 foot long. They used to have them on the slipway and build them. They used to frame them up and whatnot, and then put all the iron L's and I's and also at the bottom, the bottom that used to sit in the seating, or there was a seating used to sit on a pintle
that's right, yes.
There in the curved dressing,
yes.
So it could, yes, footbridge bridge. Now, I believe.
Yes, there is.
But
yeah.
That came with the factory.
We really ought to sort of ask you what you remember about that area. tell us about where you live, first of all.
Well, I lived in Hills Lane, that's off West Fen Road.
Yeah.
And then and I was apprenticed at the Doppler's. He was a Frenchman, and very strict. And we had what you'd call all the posh people, come to him because he's, they thought that was funny because he was French. Mind you, he's a good hairdresser. And and then my father had a heart attack, so we had to move down. They offered him the house down by the factory, one of the staff houses, which was lovely. Had a great big garden and everything. Ideal for him because his office was at the bottom of the road. But not so good for me because after I served my apprenticeship, I wanted a change, and I wasn't allowed to work in Ely. It had to be 6 miles radius of Ely. That was in my contract. And so I went
because
to...
Because you were a hairdresser.
Yeah, yes. Because I'd be taking the customers with me. So,
yeah.
So I went to Soham, and I worked there 5 years, and I liked Soham. I liked the people, very nice, got on well with them. And then so, I got married and gave up work. That was it.
But you did walk... How old were you when you moved to the Sugar Beet?
When we were talking about that, I think I was about 18 and a half, because I'd got a sister 10 years younger than me, you see.
Okay.
And, everybody sort of chattered to you then. Mm-hmm. You know, when you went down by... Because then, of course, I had to cycle up to Ely, get the bus to Soham. And all the workmen used to wave, and the train driver, because I used to ride, I wouldn't dare do it now, but I think used to go along the railway line, because that's a shortcut to where we lived. And the railwaymen used to sound out and wave, everybody was so friendly there.
What was it like when you were riding, when it was dark in the winter then, riding down?
Yes, I had my bike, with the lights on, and I used to go down past the office, because I used to do... See, being a hairdresser, there's always somebody... I used to do hairdressing in Ely. I wasn't supposed to, but I did. I used to go to people's houses. And that'd be 10, half past 10, I'd be riding past the office, down the hill, along the railway line, and never thought anything about it.
Were the people about, the workmen? railway?
Well, they're always the night watchman for the factory.
Yeah.
And, of course, there'd always be somebody on the gates, you know, at the bottom of the hill.
Yeah, was there somebody at night on there?
I think so.
A crossing keeper.
But, yes. Mm.
And where you live, was there one house or more than one house?
Oh, no, there was... let me think. I've got to think. There's chief electrician. Then there was... I have to think. Tom Long... Harrimars, Tate, Lane, and then Cook and Fuller's.
So about six, is that about six?
There's two double ones. But we were in the, what they called the Wheel Cottage. That was in the Idea Home exhibition. Yes. All made of wood.
Oh, right.
Yes, it was. I've got photographs of it somewhere. The front was at the back. Mm-hmm. If you can understand,
front doors at the back.
And the trains, a little train used to go past our house.
Yeah.
When the factory was going, you know, you could really smell the sweet bit. But we never took any notice of it.
No.
Everybody down there was friendly, you know, lovely. You know, my mother used to have them in for coffee, and Dad used to have something to do with the garden. You know, that was like a little community on its own. It was lovely, really lovely.
And presumably you could walk the way into Queen Adelaide, could you? Could you get through Queen Adelaide?
If you went by road, you'd go round, there used to be a little school at the corner, and that was a long road up to the factory, you know, I used to go past the factory, and round, the houses were sort of right at the back, you know what I mean. No, you could hear the trains go because I think they went to Peterborough or Norwich and that. Oh, yes, you could hear the trains. You could at the bottom of our road, because my father used to go fishing, you could walk onto the ride and you could get up to you'd go over Cuckoo Bridge.
Yeah.
But I remember as a young, I think my father forgot his packing up, you know, they used to take sandwiches. And me and my brothers went. I can remember walking across the pits, you know, what was the pits, you know, all grass, you know. It used to sort of be like a little pathway over. When I was at school, I left school at 14, but there at the palace, you know, in the green, that used to be a
convalescent.
And I used to go, they used to come to the school and ask for volunteers to either clean oyster spoons or wash out ties.
Right.
And that was used to do that on a Saturday morning.
Used
to wash the ties out.
The ties?
Red ties.
Oh, right.
Red ties and to clean the silver. It's, you know, that's living in Hills Lane.
When you were about 12?
About 12. And we got up a concert and for the Red Cross, in aid of the Red Cross. And we had all the neighbours in my back garden. And we all done a little piece, and I think I collected, that's in the Ely Standard, because my friend Doreen, who was friendly and who came, it was in the concert, and she said, "Faith, have you seen in the Ely Standard?" I said, "No." She said, "It's about us doing that concert." I collected, I think, which in those days, 14 shillings, and I sent it to the Red Cross, Lady Churchill, and she wrote me a letter thanking me. And then somebody gave me some more money. I mean, I haven't got any idea. But I went and got what money was given to me. I went and got to the post office, got a postal order, and posted that off to her. And she sent me this lovely letter thanking us for our effort during the war. And that's in the Ely Standard about that. And I can't find the letter.